Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin, executive editor at the Mises Institute. And today we're going to talk about the Federal Reserve and how it's losing a whole lot of money and that this is actually something they did not anticipate. And we're going to look at the guts of the Federal Reserve a little bit and really just sort of examine the way it's run from the inside and how some of it's kind of a little bit sketchy, a little bit shady. And to do that today, we have our senior fellow from the Mises Institute on today, and that's Alex J. Pollack. Now, Alex, you've seen on our show, but it's been more than a year since he was on. But he's got a long background in mortgage finance, in finance in general, in Federal Reserve policy. He's been an observer of it for a very long time, and just some of his bio is principal deputy director of the Office of Financial Research in the U.S. Treasury Department. That was a few years ago. Before that, he was also president and CEO of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Chicago for, 14 years, it looks like. And he's got a few books that I can recommend: Finance and Philosophy, Why We're Always Surprised, that's from 2018, and then more recently, Boom and Bust, Financial Cycles and Human Prosperity. Oh, no, that's his older one, that's 2011. And then he's got a more recent book, Surprised Again, which is kind of a sequel, I think, to Why We're Always Surprised. So given that a long and illustrious background, I want to talk about the Fed a little bit with you today, Alex. So welcome. And I want to mention that we're going to be basically kind of riffing off an article that you have at Law and Liberty this morning. Well, this morning being Wednesday, we're recording this on Wednesday, but if you go there here this week, you'll find it there near the top. And this article is called Duplicity at the Fed. This is co-authored with you and someone with whom you collaborate a lot, Paul Kupiec. And so, Alex, in this article, you look at the issue of how the Federal Reserve is losing billions of dollars. And the subtitle really, and you note in your article, that the Fed is concealing this loss of taxpayer dollars through dubious accounting practices. So I'm hoping that, just for starters, so our authors kind of have a sense, or our listeners have a sense of, what are we talking about when you say the Fed is losing billions of dollars? What do you mean by that? Can you walk us through that a little bit about how that process works?
Yes, but first of all, let me thank you, Ryan, for having me on. It's always a great pleasure to share ideas with you. When we say that the Fed is losing, it's losing big numbers. As of last week, the accumulated losses of the Federal Reserve System combined — there are, of course, 12 Federal Reserve banks. That's where all of the assets and liabilities are. And if you add them all up, they have lost, in the aggregate, starting in the fourth quarter of 2022 to now, $234 billion. $234 billion. This is a really big number. When we say lost, we mean something very simple. Their expenses are greater than their income up to that amount. They have lost money every month for 33 months in a row. That's a pretty interesting record for the greatest central bank in the world. I do think they are the greatest central bank in the world, but they also have these enormous losses. They have the enormous losses because their balance sheet, in one respect, looks exactly like a 1980s SNL. That is to say, they invested in very long fixed rate assets in 30-year mortgages. Another issue is why the Fed is holding mortgages at all, which they shouldn't be, but they have over $2 trillion invested in 30-year mortgages and in very long government bonds, which they bought on average to yield around 2% back at the bottom. So at the bottom of yields, which is the top — they were big buyers at the top of the market. Their own buying was creating the top of the market and was creating the bottom in yields. And now interest rates have gone back to normal levels, say around 4 or 5%. That's a normal short-term interest rate, historically speaking. The short-term interest rates were abnormally low because the Fed made and kept them abnormally low for many years. So they bought these things for 2% at the time. To finance them, they were paying on their deposits maybe 0.25%. That would look pretty good. Make 2%, pay 0.25%. Now interest rates are back to normal. So they're paying on their deposits around something just over 4%. But they're still only making 2% on the investments. So as I like to say, it's very hard to make money when you're investing at 2% and borrowing at over 4%. And this on an amount of, let's say in round numbers, $4 trillion. And the result was these enormous losses. Now, two, as I say, the losses started in the fourth quarter of 2022. They lost over $100 billion in 2023. They lost around $80 billion in 2024. And they lost money every month in 2025 so far to add up to this enormous figure. Now, it might occur to you to ask, well, if you've lost $234 billion, real losses, these are operating losses. These are in no sense what people call a paper loss. Because the paper loss is something much bigger than that. Come to that in a minute. The real loss, meaning you paid out in cash, in expenses, more than you took in income, is this number we have been talking about. Well, you might ask, well, how does a loss of $234 billion, it'll be bigger this week. The Fed reports its balance sheet once a week. When we look at it tomorrow, the loss will be bigger than it was last week. How does it compare to their capital? Well, how much is their capital? Well, if you add together their paid-in capital and their retained earnings that they started with 2.75 years ago, 33 months ago, that number is $46 billion. I had $46 billion in capital. That seems like a lot. Wait a minute. You lost $234 billion. Well, you've lost five times your capital. You've run through your entire capital, and you've run through it five times over. Well, that's pretty remarkable thing to do. The meaning of that is that the real capital of the Fed is let's put it the other way around. It's $46 billion in capital minus $234 billion in losses, which means the real capital is negative $188 billion. Negative $188 billion is their capital. But if you look on their balance sheet, you will never find this true number because they engage in, as Paul Kupiec and I say in this article, duplicity. That is to say, they don't give you the real number on their own balance sheet. Well, wouldn't you think it's pretty embarrassing for the world's greatest central bank not even to present its balance sheet accurately according to worldwide accepted standards? That is to say, if you lose money, you have to subtract the losses from your capital. There's no more fundamental accounting principle than that, but the Fed doesn't do it. So that's a pretty embarrassing view. They ought to be displaying a good example of accounting probity, but they're displaying the opposite. Why not? Why aren't they displaying the true state? Well, they don't want to show the world they've got a giant negative capital growing more negative every week, every month, and will continue for a while, for some time. So it's a really fascinating one. How did the Fed got itself into this situation where they've lost enormous amounts of money? They did it by making their balance sheet into the equivalent of a 1980s savings and loan, investing long and borrowing short and having interest rates rise. Man, that is banking 101. That's the simplest mistake you can make. It's the same thing that sank Silicon Valley Bank. That's what they did. And it's sunk many places, including, of course, hundreds and hundreds of savings and loans 40 years ago. So that's an interesting case. Now, of course, they have reasons why they wanted to make these investments and keep on making them. They don't seem good reasons to me, but they are there. But what they never had was the expectation of what would happen to them. Nowhere do you find a statement that, well, we know if we do this, we're going to lose $200 billion. No. No, all their forecasts are that, well, interest rates won't rise that much. You know, if interest rates are 0.25%, you say, well, what if they went up to 2? You know, that would be a big increase. But we could survive that. Yeah, but not if they go up to 4 or 5. So we have this very interesting situation with the Federal Reserve's own income statement and balance sheet. And remember, the Federal Reserve banks are banks. Well, not only are they called banks, actually, are banks. They have deposits, they have loans, they have investments, they have capital. Or perhaps we put that in the past tense, they used to have capital. Who owns their capital? Private investors, the private banks, own the capital of the Fed. What should they be thinking about with these losses? They probably are too timid to express any opinion. Anyway,
well, do they have any choice, though, in that, Alex? Like, right? I mean, they're the private banks. They have to be stockholders, right?
If they're a national bank, they have to be stockholders. The Federal Reserve Act requires all national banks, which is all the big banks, to be members and therefore stockholders in their regional Federal Reserve Bank. You're a stockholder of a particular Federal Reserve Bank, because the thing was originally designed in a Jeffersonian Federalist system. Carter Glass, one of the major designers of the Fed, was a Jeffersonian from Virginia. Anyway, but if you're a state chartered bank, or you have the choice. If you want to be a member of the Fed, then you must buy stock. But you don't have to be a member. So many banks are not Fed members, but all of the big banks that matter are Fed members. And
so they could complain, but it's not like they can withdraw from the system, though, right? So
you could withdraw from the system.
By changing their charter?
Someday, you know, if you want to have access to the discount window in case of hard times, and if you're a bank holding company as distinct from the bank, you are regulated by the Fed. And, you know, Fed historically hasn't looked too favorably on people who withdraw from it. Anyway, yes. Now, the final point I want to make is this paper losses. So paper losses, as generally discussed, mean if you take your assets and you mark them to market, minus any gains you might have on liabilities, mark to market, how much is your loss? And the answer is, in round numbers, for the combined Federal Reserve, their paper losses are $1 trillion. That is to say, if they actually sold their investments, they would lose $1 trillion. But of course, they couldn't. We're talking about $6 trillion here. I always say, I play this little scene in my mind. You're a bond trader for J.P. Morgan, and you get a nice call from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It says, I'd like a bid for $6 trillion. Well, it would destroy the market. They can't. They're much too big. They can't get out. They can't really sell it. But just marking their market at current prices, they're down $1 trillion. And that means that's the market's best estimate of the long-term effect. Well, you know, that's fascinating that the central bank has gotten itself into this shape. I'm sorry for this very long answer to your very short question.
Well, and just for our listeners who don't follow bonds closely, right, this all follows very logically, because we need to remember that as yields go up, so we're talking about rising interest rates in recent years, so that means the prices of these instruments are going down, which would suggest lesser demand, right? The demand isn't there to support these lower yields that were being supported in earlier times. So you can see how they would, if they just dumped all that stuff on the market, it would, right? That would just further push yields up, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's
right. In a larger sense, right?
If the Fed actually tried to sell its position, it would push bond yields higher, and it would make their losses, their actual losses, bigger.
Uh-huh. And we say that sort of, right, whenever, you can bring this into other discussions too, where people never consider that issue, is there's all this stuff that's worth something on paper, and they say, oh, just sell it all and we'll get all this revenue. Well, the act of selling it lessens the price because now there's all this stuff out there. People say that about, oh, the federal government could just sell all of its land and all that land's worth X amount of dollars, as if just selling all that land in the market would not affect its value. Same with all these billionaires who have huge amounts of stock, right? Their value is based on their stock holdings. And they don't actually have that much cash, right? So a billionaire, Elon Musk, if he's actually started selling all of the stock that's behind his net worth, the value would crash because there would suddenly be all of this stuff for sale out there. So
that is the paradox of market prices. It's the price as long as there is a fairly normal level of activity. But once everybody decides to sell, that price no longer exists. It's some much lower price.
And so the Fed's
just
kind of... So
that gives me, this is my favorite two questions about financial markets. And I use this about mortgages in particular to make the point. If you are an investor and you own a mortgage, let's say a residential mortgage, what is the collateral that you have for your mortgage, for your exposure to the mortgage?
You have the house.
That's what,
yes,
what you think. It's the house.
Okay.
The correct answer is it's the price of the house.
Ah, okay.
It's what you can sell the house for. It's not the house itself. It's the price of the house. And question two is, how far can a price go down? My answer is, farther than you think.
It can go below zero, I mean, in practical sense, right? Because you can just have this big white elephant of a house.
It can go to a point that's lower than your worst case scenario that you ran to in your risk management meeting.
I was a state economist during, of course, the last housing crisis, right?
There you go.
We remember all the talk about short sales, just all of that real estate that really had no market value.
Yeah, then there's no market. Right.
And so you just had all of this, physical stuff that nobody wanted. Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty bad case scenario, I would say.
So here is the Fed. The Fed has $6 trillion of very long-term bonds and mortgages, which they're pretty well stuck with huge losses and with ongoing operating losses and negative capital. So now what the Fed says, and they could be right about this, is nobody cares if we have negative capital. They don't care because we are the Fed. We can print up money, as all those of us at the Mises Institute are fond of pointing out. But I say, well, if nobody cares, why don't you issue a balance sheet with the true number? Why are you going through all this machination trying to hide it? This was not the historical accounting policy of the Fed. They changed their policy in 2011. It's sort of an announcement that they slipped in that not too many people noticed, although some of us noticed it at the time and said, that's ridiculous. But anyway, that's when they realized that they might make some losses, and they didn't want to have it affect their reported capital. So they changed their accounting. Which leads us to another interesting example. Most people, keep them according to generally accepted accounting principles. That is to say, somebody else sets the standards and you apply them. There are generally accepted accounting principles for private corporations, which are enforced by the SEC if you have public securities. And there's GAAP, or generally accepted accounting principles, for government organizations established by FASAB, which is a government body. It's supposed to set accounting standards. But who sets the Fed's accounting standards?
The Fed, I guess.
Unbelievably, the Fed itself.
Right.
They claim the power to decide how they're going to present their books. That's something that I've suggested Congress could fix. say no. You have to keep your books according to accepted accounting, and that is to say real accounting standards. But they just changed their accounting policy, and they changed it so that they could hide the effect of their losses on the capital. They do report the loss, but then they do something interesting. They account for their loss as an asset. And I just want you to think about this. They present their hundreds of billions of losses as an asset. That's an asset might be tough to sell to anyone, actually. And when they do that, then they, instead of reducing their capital with their loss, which they should do, they pretend it's an asset, and then they don't reduce their capital. That's actually, to my mind, amazing behavior, and many people seem not to notice it, or don't want to notice it, or don't want to talk about it. But Mises Institute notices such things, and it really calls into question the, in my opinion, the behavior of the Fed. So that, hence the duplicity or the dubious accounting practices which we mentioned.
Well, this brings us nicely to my next question, which is, and you bring this up in your article, is this issue of Fed independence, quote unquote.
Oh, yeah.
Right, which is, there seems to be no clear definition of what this means. But whenever the Fed wants to get away with something, they say, oh, we're an independent organization. But the point you make, of course, is, well, the idea was that they're supposed to be independent from the executive branch and like daily political stuff, right? But they're not independent of the Congress, right?
Which that's right. Well, the idea that you could have a government agency which is fully independent and can do anything it wants within its domain is an absolutely unconstitutional idea. Every part of the government, and with Fed is part of the government, although it has this odd link to private shareholders, nonetheless, it's part of the government, and it has to be, in our constitutional republic, embedded in a system, checks and balances and oversight and accountability. So all this claiming by the Fed itself that it's somehow independent is, in my judgment, just nonsense. In principle, you can't be independent and be part of the constitutional republic. Now, I think what it does mean, Ryan, as you said a minute ago, is the Fed is a creature of Congress. It is not part of the executive branch. And if you see why that might be, the executive branch has two overwhelmingly dominant pieces. One is the military, Department of Defense, which used to be more honestly called the Department of War. In previous days, and the Treasury. The Treasury, which is responsible for taxing and spending, only the Treasury likes to spend more than it taxes, as all politicians like to make you happy by giving you money, but not make you happy by taking your money. And so what's the answer? You borrow. And if the private market doesn't want to lend you money, what do you do then? You borrow from your central bank. So historically speaking, the origin of central banks, and still the single most important thing that central banks do, and you will never find this in the PR of any modern central bank, but it is nonetheless the case, is to lend money to the government of which it's a part. The Treasury is a natural borrower, and the Fed is the lender. Well, you can see why, if you were designing the central bank wisely, you wouldn't want the borrower to be able to order the lender to do it. Now, nonetheless, it has happened historically. It happens in times of big wars. In wars, the Fed becomes just the willing servant, or you might say the controlled finance subsidiary of the Treasury. But as a structural idea, you can see why you don't want to say, well, the executive can just spend whatever it wants and order the Fed to finance it. That's it. So the Fed fits under, is accountable to the Congress. Under the Constitution, with utterly unambiguous and clear import. The money power belongs to the Congress. Famous article, one language, to coin money and regulate the value thereof. That is a congressional power. It is not an executive power. And it wouldn't make sense to have it be an executive power for the reasons I just mentioned. And that is the power to which the Fed, under which the Fed fits and must report to the, or should be reporting to the Congress in that way. There's another congressional power, which is very important, which is the taxation power. Again, a purely congressional power. You can't have the executive just putting in taxes. That belongs to the elected representatives of the people. And the Fed is also a taxing power because inflation is a tax. And when the Fed prints up money and creates inflation, it's in fact taxing the people to finance the government. Well, that taxing power is also a congressional power. So there's no question at all that the Fed, however much it wants to be independent, and however much it hates the idea that it somehow works for those elected representatives who don't know anything about our 2,000, or maybe it's 20,000 equation model of the economy, they're still the boss. And need to be for questions like how much inflation can we stand? Do you really want perpetual inflation, or do we want sound money? Those are political questions. And are we really going to tax the people by destroying the purchasing power of the people's money and spending it on the government instead? That is a political question up to the elected representatives of the people. So, just in sum, the idea that the Fed is somehow independent and a power unto itself is nonsense. It is responsible to and accountable to the Congress.
Well, in letting the Fed justify for itself whatever it is doing, I think could be the trouble with that is illustrating how they got themselves into this SNL mess to begin with. Right? Sure, interest rates might go up, but we'll deal with that problem some other time, right? I'm sure it'll be fine.
Did they ever come to the Congress and say, listen, this is what we want to do, and here's the risk, and here's what this might turn into, and we'd like your approval to carry out this incredible speculation on interest rates that we made, which if we lose, we're going to be spending taxpayers' money. It's another issue. When the Fed is losing money, where does the money come from that it's still spending? It's borrowing it and spending it ultimately at the risk of the government, that is to say the taxpayers. It ought, in my opinion, it ought in some way to be requiring appropriations to do that. That's a delicious picture in your mind. You have the Fed going up and asking for appropriations to spend the money that they're losing.
Well, and they would say that violates independence, right? They shouldn't have
they
to go
would,
and
yeah. Oh,
beg
we can't
for
do that.
Permission.
Then we wouldn't be independent, and to which the answer is right.
We wouldn't be. And we should know, by the way, for those who don't remember, that these sudden new powers that the Fed got, oh, let's just buy up a bunch of mortgage-backed securities. This was a new thing. This wasn't like something imagined by Congress in earlier years. It didn't go through some sort of political debate. Oh, should we let the Fed just buy it?
No, the Fed just decided to do that. Something that's important here is they did get permission, approval of the Congress to pay interest on their deposits. Because they could see that they wanted to do this big investment. And historically, the Fed never paid interest on deposits. And any deposits the banks held at the Fed were non-interest bearing.
And this is the same when we talk about interest on reserves.
Reserves. Okay. Reserves just means a deposit that the bank holds with the Fed. Yes.
It used to be excess reserves too, right? Until recently, and now it's all reserves.
They used to have required reserves, and any deposit you had that was greater than that was called an excess reserve. And then excess reserves got to be I don't know, hundreds of times bigger than required reserves, so it got sort of embarrassing to have excess that was most of everything. So they just got rid of required.
Well, it's good you brought that up, because that is a big change. And when did that happen? When did they switch over to paying
interest? I believe it was in the statute around 2008. It was under Bernanke. I think Ben Bernanke, the most radical Fed chairman in history. One of the radical changes he made was to get the power to pay interest on reserves. I'll talk in a minute about that as an issue. Because that's the source of the loss. When you have to pay interest on your reserves, then you can lose money, and a lot of money. Yeah, he also came up with investing in mortgages, which, in my opinion, the central bank, the historical position of the Fed was we should not do anything that favors a particular sector like housing. And so we know we don't want to invest in mortgages, but they started doing that. And then they did the immense interest rate risky investing in bonds. One of my favorite item in the portfolio of the Fed is, I think it's a 1.75% Treasury bond maturing in 2050 or something like that. So they bought, that's a nice example of the very long term, what now looks like a terrible decision to buy that. Under Bernanke, they also did this accounting change to create a misleading, let's call it something kind, a misleading balance sheet. Those were all decisions. Now, of course, they were in stressful times, and we were in a big financial crisis, and so on. But nonetheless, they were radical moves. This is so little understood. I think the Federal Reserve has, I think, the greatest public relations department or public relations activity of any entity in the world. They are amazingly good at it. And they're hugely good at lobbying and at political. They're just immensely successful. And at managing the press and at managing the Congress and at getting their words out. I have a friend who likes to put things into ChatGPT about the Fed and see what it says, and now and then he sends what this little AI system says about the Fed. And my response is it reads just like a Federal Reserve press release. What AI comes back, or at least what ChatGPT comes back with, which is a great example of how amazingly successful at PR the Fed is. They're really, I mean, you have to admire it. They're really good. I wish we at Mises were as good as they are. I don't mean we're not good, but they're amazing.
Well, we don't have quite as many people in our employ.
No, and we don't
either.
Have as much money to spend.
Well, this brings me to my last question, though, on this issue, is if you were in charge, if I was in charge, right, how could the Fed start to extricate itself from this problem? What are some things that they can do to stop the loss, stop the bleeding, return to normalcy, quote unquote? What could be done?
Senator Cruz, as you know, has said, well, why are they paying interest on these deposits? They didn't used to. In fact, it was taken as a principle of nature that reserves or deposits at the Fed were non-interest bearing. So if you stopped paying interest on reserves, the losses would disappear that day because your cost of funds would become zero. And then your 2% yield would look pretty good compared to zero. But there's a slight problem. As soon as you did that, the banks who hold, it's $3.3 trillion in deposits at the Federal Reserve that are held by the banks. Well, they're not going to want to hold zero interest rate deposits when they can invest on T-bills and get 4%. So they'll be trying to cash in their deposits and get out of them. Something little understood, I think, is that any individual bank can do that, could lend out its Fed funds to another bank, want to buy others, you know, make loans, do anything. But every individual bank will not want to hold its deposits and try to get out of them. But the banking system as a whole cannot get out of its aggregate position. That's the nature of a fiat currency central banking system. There's nothing you can redeem in the aggregate of all the banks together. There's nothing they can redeem their Federal Reserve deposits for, except Federal Reserve notes. You could ask for currency. Well, those are non-interest-bearing, too. You could turn your currency back in and get deposits. But for the banking system as a whole, once the Fed creates those deposit accounts, only the Fed can reduce them. It can reduce them by getting out of its investments. All right. So what would happen? All the banks would be trying to get out of their deposits to lend them. Well, first of all, let's say they all try to lend Fed funds to each other. Well, what's going to happen is the Fed funds rate falls dramatically. In short, the Fed would lose control of interest rates. It can't keep control of interest rates and stop paying interest under current circumstances on its deposits. A historical theory of central banking and banking is that because the banks will try to get out of their non-interest-bearing reserves, they will cause a credit expansion. They'll make loans, they'll make investments. But no matter what they do, they'll still be $3 trillion in the aggregate they can't get out of. They can just add other things on top of them. Well, the Fed doesn't want that credit expansion. The Fed could sell, in theory, its investments. They'd be taking giant losses. And we discussed before the problem when you own a huge part of the market, $6 trillion, you can't get out of the $6 trillion. And you could sell very small amounts, but you'd have to be scared that you weren't telegraphing to the bond traders that there would be hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars coming, because as soon as you do that, we, as they say, their bids would back up. And the prices of bonds would go down, and the long-term rates would rise. So they're in a tough position. The solution they've come up with is just wait. Over time, these very long-term investments will slowly mature. The mortgages will pay down little by little as you make your monthly mortgage payment. If that mortgage is in a mortgage-backed security, that the amount of that mortgage-backed security goes down by the amount of your principal payment, even though they're very long, the treasury bonds will ultimately mature, so you can just sit around and wait. You could try to get interest rates much lower. So if the Fed took interest rates back to 2%, then it would be breaking even on its 2% investments. But it shouldn't and doesn't want to do that for other reasons, inflationary and so they've gotten themselves in well and truly into a tough spot, you would have to say.
On
the other hand, they're going to really enjoy their new headquarters building when they finish the $2.5 billion luxurious renovation they're doing.
I posted a link about that at Mises.org about their new fabulous offices. Yeah, unbelievable. Wow. That was one chink in their PR machine, I think, right there.
That's
Alex.
True. They're working hard. That one's tough to cover up.
Well, thank you for explaining
that. They've been great on this accounting issue. They've gotten all kinds of people simply to repeat. Well, we just take these losses and we book them as they call it a deferred asset. And then everything's fine. And it's amazing how reporters who need to have their feed from the Fed to write their daily stories, and we'll just repeat them. As I say, very impressive PR. Not so impressive profit performance.
Well, I mean, the way you state it, right? The whole wait and see, wait and pray, wait and hope policy, which seems to be the policy at the moment. I can see why you would do that when all the other options are so horrible in terms of trying to unwind all of this stuff.
And when other options, you know, all look bad.
Yeah.
You do things you might not rather do, but I think they're well and truly in a tough place with respect to the giant risk position that they took, and they're just upside down on their position, and will be unless rates fall dramatically, and there we are.
It's just kind of, it's a nice case study and illustration of what happens when you let the technocrats do whatever they want, right? They get themselves into these situations. And this is what Fed independence got us.
It's very true, and it's what the belief that there can be some philosopher kings who can make, so-called manage the economy and know what they're doing. They don't. And there I have to say Chairman Powell has been very good in his candor about the impossibility to know what they're really doing. They're guessing like everybody else, and that's why their forecasts are so bad and so often wildly wrong. Just like everybody else's, like yours and mine.
Yes.
Because nobody knows. And Chairman Powell had this great line, we're navigating by the stars on a cloudy night. I think that deserves to be memorialized forever about the true nature of what a central bank is doing. Navigating by the stars when you can't see the stars.
Well, something I point out, I mean, I'm on some nonprofit like finance, volunteer stuff and things like that. And anytime the topic of interest rates come up, I get asked, you know, what do you think is going to happen? But I always say, if I knew what was going to happen with interest rates, I'd be a bond trader. I wouldn't be sitting here right now doing this, folks. I'd be
You're so right.
Living
and
it
the
up.
same is true of the Fed. And they're the biggest bond trader by far, or at least the biggest bond holder by far. In the country. There's one other thing that I'd like to mention, Ryan, if I could. Here are a set of banks which are losing a couple hundred billion dollars. Their actual capital is negative. They're still paying dividends to their shareholders. We mentioned before how the stock is owned by private banks. How can you still be paying dividends when you have no earnings, and you have no retained earnings, and you have no capital? They
must
should
be a political
be
decision, right?
It's a political decision. Why the banks would hate it if they couldn't get their dividends on their stock. But it's, I think, a very pertinent question. And again, it goes to, well, I think you said, your comment there summed it up nicely. These turn into political questions. There is no technocratic central banking. There is only political central banking, which is why you have to have political accountability and oversight.
Right. Yeah, this idea that we can have value-free central banking, where it's just we put it into a spreadsheet that tells us what to do, right? Just fake. No such thing has ever occurred. I mean, just amazing that some people believe that, but that probably goes to the Fed's brilliance in terms of public relations.
Oh, they have created this mystique. The mystique of the Fed is really formidable and really quite amazing. So perhaps our conversation will help dilute that mystique a bit.
Well, lest we sound like we're ending on praise of the Fed, but hey, they are good at some things. We should go ahead and wrap up this episode of Radio Rothbard. Thank you, Alex, for joining me today. I actually learned a lot. I mean, the way you've kind of pointing out just the reason they can't stop paying interest on reserves, right? I just haven't thought about it in that way before. So very helpful. Thank you very much. Everyone out there, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Ryan.